This next hour, we hear a panel discussion on the future of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board, or GAB. There's a move from Wisconsin's Republican Party leadership to dismantle the state's independent government watchdog and ethics agency, the GAB. Republican leaders say the GAB needs to be accountable to the state legislature, but Democrats insist the GAB must remain independent of political influence. The panelists include Kevin Kennedy, director of the GAB, David Cannon, UW-Madison, professor of political science, Mike McCabe, former director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and current director of Blue Jean Nation, Dale Schultz, former Republican state senator from Richland Center, and Judge Gerald Nickel, the current chair of the GAB. The talk took place on October 10, 2015, at the Sequoia Public Library in Madison. The talk was sponsored by the Madison Institute. First, we hear from Fred Wade, chair of the Madison Institute, who introduces the panel.
As you may know, there is now a bill that's been proposed that would dismantle the Elections Board as it has been created and operated for the last 8 years, and replace it with a separate Elections Board and a separate Ethics Board, which was kind of the system we had before. The sponsors of the bill to replace the Government Accountability Board made a brief statement as they were circulating the bill, and this is what their premise is for seeking the change that will be under consideration. Say the 8-year experiment with the Government Accountability Board has turned out to be a failure. The GAB has come to represent extreme partisanship, a staff run amok, a centralization of power that hinders real and accountable oversight. Our first speaker will be Kevin Kennedy, the director of the Government Accountability Board. He has served in that capacity for about 8 years now, I believe. Got his law degree in 1976. He applied for a state attorney job, and the first interview he got, I understand, was with the old Elections Board. He's been working in elections administration ever since.
It's Saturday morning, and I'm running amok. The hardest part about this is not getting too defensive. The Government Accountability Board was created, it came out of the caucus scandal and the frustration that the old Elections Board, which I had served as the director of for 20-some years and its staff counsel for three-plus years, was not doing enough to respond to that, and the old Ethics Board was not. The old Elections Board was a bipartisan board, but it was not a balanced board as they're proposing here. Each of the four legislative leaders nominated someone to the governor for consideration for appointment, and the political parties that had 10% of the vote, each their chairperson got to make a nomination. And then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court got to make a nomination, and the governor selected the eighth person. For a brief period of time, the Libertarians had a member on that board from 2003 to 2007, because in 2002, Governor Thompson's brother got a little over 10% of the vote for governor. So that's how they got an additional voice on the board. And this legislation recognizes if we ever have a party that has 10% of the vote for governor, they would have a seat on each of these two new commissions as it's created. But one of the concerns that also came out of this wasn't that the old board didn't have the resources to do investigations and was too close to the regulated. But it was also that if the customers who went to those boards were often the same customers, and they had to go two places to get answers. It's a lot of frustration when someone would call me up and ask a question, and I'd have to say, well, I can give you the elections and campaign financer, but you know, as far as your conflict of interest and lobbying issue, you're going to have to go call Rothstad at the Ethics Board. We're now going to lose that, and there's a lot of interplay between those that I think people forget. To get on the ballot in Wisconsin, you have to file statements of economic interest, revealing the sources of your personal income. You have to file campaign finance reports, and they're going to be separating those activities, and it's going to make it harder for people running for public office to get that one-stop shopping, or for the public officials that we serve to ask a question and know, oh, well, you know, that depends on the election season, but I don't know when that is. You'll have to go talk to the Elections Commission. That's one of the very practical issues that we're going to see. It's going to come back. The current board consists of six former judges, and I always sort of get my backup when they say six retired judges, because they're far from retired. They may no longer be serving on the bench, but these are very active and engaged individuals that are serving here. And what they bring to this board, and they're not the sole repository of this, but they bring an experience as trained decision makers. One of the myths about the GAB is that those old judges don't have the subject matter expertise to deal with this. And so their proposal is to bring in two former clerks on the election side and people with definite partisan ties. Otherwise, the value that our board members bring is that they're trained decision makers. They're used to having both sides put something in front of them to analyze it and make a decision. We don't know what the quality of the new commission members would be if they come in. I can tell you when I worked on the elections board, there were some very, very talented people. My experience as a lawyer when I was an assistant district attorney was just the DA and I in West Bend, Wisconsin. So I didn't get a whole lot of mentoring there. When I was in private practice, it was just that attorney and I, and he thought that after a short time in the DA's office, I was his trial expert. So let me state the one thing that I think this is all about, and that is control. Legislative control over an independent executive branch agency. If you look at the structure of the proposals, they're not taking away a lot of what's in place. They're not taking away any of the secrecy that shrouds our actions. Whenever there's an investigation or an opinion request, we can't talk about the particulars of that. And one of the biggest criticisms that comes out is we're not transparent enough. The legislature doesn't know what we are doing. And they don't know what we're doing because they don't have someone on the inside. But they're the ones that said, staff and board, if you reveal any complaint you have, any discussions you have about that complaint, it all has to be done behind closed doors. And then we get criticized because we're not accountable. That stays the same in this bill. It doesn't change. There's some benefit when someone's asking for ethics advice to shroud that in secrecy, to encourage someone. That's been sort of the concept. I've got an ethical dilemma. It may involve financing of a private business. Do I have a conflict? But if I tell the world about it, it could ruin the financing issue. Or it could be a very sensitive issue. And there's some benefit to encouraging public officials to ask for advice about conflicts of interest by saying, you can come to us, your request will be confidential, the advice will be confidential unless you choose to make it public. If it's formal, we are charged with putting that in a redacted format so you get some general guidance. We got criticized one time because they said that the redaction wasn't good enough. Well, it only applied to one person who happened to hold the highest executive position in state government. And it's kind of hard to hide that even when you redact those questions. But that transparency that they're talking about isn't going to be achieved under the bill proposal. It's going to stay the same. There were two suggestions that were made about just reforming the GAB. One was, and this is something I said when they created the GAB, lobbying issues, campaign finance issues, and election issues, the complaints, the discussion, the opinion requests should all be public. The public should be able to hear that, see where that's coming from. It was nothing new with respect to campaign finance, nothing new with respect to elections. That's the way the old elections board operated. When the staff prepared a memo, not only did the people who filed their complaint and respond have their kicks at the cat and the board members discuss it, but the whole public could read the memo and do their analysis. The press could write up and they could note where the board deviated from the staff's recommendations. They could note how closely did the staff's recommendation parallel the complainant or the respondent. It was a great tool for the public. That all got lost with the current board, with the exception of elections. When it comes to ethics, I think there's some basis for keeping that. But as we're looking at restructuring, I think we should be talking about opening that up, letting people see the staff memos, letting them see the commission discussion. The board would certainly be comfortable with that kind of discussion if we had it. The other proposal that came up was something that Judge Nickel and I talked about over the past year or so, and he put it in writing, and that is, if you really don't trust this group of nonpartisan board members and nonpartisan staff, let's have two partisan advocates who get to see all of the stuff that I just talked about, get to see the deliberations, get to put in their own 2 cents worth from a partisan perspective. They don't get a vote under the proposal, but it does get them a seat at the table in the discussion, a seat that they would have if we took away the shroud of secrecy that prevails over this. Those are the key points I wanted to make, that this is really an attempt to control something that other states have a history of. You know, one of the myths, I said I was going to sit down, was is that nobody ever adopted this. And nobody ever adopted this because the stakes are very high. There's a reason why 37 elected or appointed secretaries of state control elections, campaign finance, and lobbying, or where 3 lieutenant governors have that role. There's only 10 agencies that have 10 states that have bipartisan boards. One of them is Illinois, which has a sterling reputation for ethics. Well, they certainly do for enforcement. They have 4 of their last 5 governors have a cell block at Joliet. So there's a reason why we haven't moved to this. And remember, how did we get there? We got there because people in the Capitol were running election campaigns, and it was an insider both sides of the aisle secret. Not so quiet secret, but they were using state resources. That's how we got here to this point. And the question is, where are we going to go if you follow this roadmap?
Our next speaker will be David Cannon, professor in the political science department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Received his PhD in 1987 from University of Minnesota. He's the author of Race Redistricting and Representation. His most recent research concerns election administration and election reform.
So I want to make 3 points. First, to address the question of partisanship run amok. Kevin Kennedy said that he didn't want to be defensive. I'll go ahead and be defensive for him and sort of defend the GAB on that point. Second, I want to look at the proposed bill, and talk about how that really is not a model for reform, and that I think the best comparison there is the FEC at the national level, and they've shown how that bipartisan even divide leads to gridlock. And then briefly to talk about the alternative that I think would be better. So first of all, on the question of partisanship run amok, and this it seems to me is a charge that's almost there's no grounding in reality at all. And it comes from, I think, the concern and why the Republicans in the state legislature decided they wanted to dismantle the GAB. It really is fallout from the John Doe investigation and the perception that the GAB was involved in facilitating that investigation. But at the time that investigation was unfolding, the common view among people who enforced election law around the country is that coordination between the kinds of groups that were raising unlimited, undisclosed contributions and actual election campaigns like the governor's recall election campaign, coordination between those two entities was a violation of the law. And so the special prosecutors who were investigating that under the John Doe process believed that they were truly investigating violations of campaign law, which is what the GAB does. They help enforce violations of campaign finance law is one of the things they do. And so the GAB was doing nothing improper in helping out with that investigation. Indeed, they were doing exactly what they should be doing. And so when the Supreme Court stopped that investigation, that then gave ammunition to the state legislature to say, hey, see, this was unconstitutional, that this was an illegal investigation that was going on. Well, after the fact, according to the Supreme Court's decision, I mean, that clearly that is something the Supreme Court believes anyway should not have been going on. But in any event, I think that's a very unfair charge to have that as the sole basis for saying the GAB is partisanship run amok when at the time they were in good faith enforcing campaign finance law as they thought was appropriate. And more systematic investigations of the GAB, the Legislative Audit Bureau did an analysis recently of the 1,900 complaints filed between 2010 and 2013, found no basis for partisan bias on the GAB and the board. And so clearly there, you know, the most objective analysis we have, and the Legislative Audit Bureau has an excellent reputation for objective nonpartisan analysis, found that there was no basis for that charge of partisanship run amok. And then if you look at some specific high-profile cases, you can even see some cases in recent years where the GAB, you know, annoyed the Democrats as well. Two that come to mind were that recall back during the recall elections, you had these six fake Democrats that were put up to run in the primary elections. And Democrats were, you know, really upset that this was going to basically take some resources from the Democratic Party candidates who were running to have to run in these primary elections against these fake Democrats who were put up just for the purpose of exactly that, making sure that the Democrats have a harder time getting elected. And the GAB endorsed those elections and said, hey, they filed the paperwork. You know, we're not here to judge who they really are. They have a right to run in these primaries. Well, that really, you know, annoyed the Democrats and made the Republicans happy. And then you have the Prosser election, this Supreme Court race, and with the situation in Waukesha County involving the county clerk or the election clerk there, Nicholas. And there again, GAB said, well, you know, this is not something that we think we needs to be more fully investigated, and they basically endorsed the results of that election, again, making Democrats pretty unhappy. And so it seems to me that even in the high-profile cases we've had, the GAB has been very even-handed in how they interpret and apply the election law, annoying both Democrats and Republicans depending on the outcome of a given decision. And then in my own personal experience with the GAB, I had an opportunity a couple of years ago to work with a couple of my colleagues, Ken Mayer, Barry Burden, on a large grant that the GAB received from the EAC, the Federal Election Assistance Commission, where the GAB got a $2 million grant from the federal government to help improve the election administration process here in Wisconsin. And I don't know how much you know about the details of the way our elections are administered here, but we're probably the most complex state in the country for administering elections because we're the most decentralized state in the country when it comes to running elections. We have over 2,000 county and local election officials who administer elections in this state, whereas normally a state will have county is the lowest level of disaggregation. We have 2,000 election officials that the JB needs to train and needs to get information from and be able to get the data from those clerks to be able to report election statistics. So this grant was intended to improve the efficiency of that process, to make better online reporting of the data, make that data more readily available to the public. As part of that grant, we did a survey of all 2,000 clerks to help the GAB, you know, see what the clerks were thinking on various issues. And we had a chance to sit in on a variety of meetings with staff of the GAB. And I was always very impressed with the professional level of their conduct, the seriousness with which they took all of the issues before them. And, you know, it was really a very well-run organization from the interactions that we had with them. And I think the GAB and the University of Wisconsin both benefited from having that partnership and that interaction on that very important topic of election administration. So the second point then, moving to the proposed legislation and to say a little why I think that's a really a bad idea. So the proposal would be to split the GAB into the election side and the ethics side. And Kevin Kennedy's already talked about why that really is not a good idea because it would make it less efficient. But then more importantly, I think as well, is to see what happens when you move from the nonpartisan nature of the board today to the bipartisan nature that's being proposed. And we'll set aside for now the drafting error. Again, the drafting error seemed to be cropping up with some frequency recently in proposed legislation. But there is an important drafting error that I, in fact, one of the first things I looked for when I saw the bill come out was the process of appointing people to the board. And the way it's drafted actually gives the governor the ability to nominate four Republicans and two Democrats, the way it's worded right now. And so that is something that the authors of the bill say was an error, and they are going to fix that, so it would be a 3-3 split. And so assuming it will be a 3-3 split, does that mean this can work? Well, it seems to me that kind of a bipartisan approach where you have three partisans on one side three partisans on another is a recipe for gridlock. And I think we need to look no further than the FEC at the national level to see how that would play out. And the FEC has been mired in gridlock for the last several years and really has been unable to get anything done in terms of enforcing the major election laws and campaign finance laws at the national level. They too have three Democrats, three Republicans on the board. The recent comments from the FEC chair that the FEC is worse than dysfunctional and saying that we basically won't be able to enforce campaign finance law at all in the upcoming 2016 presidential election because they simply don't have the votes to do anything, I think is a pretty severe indictment of the FEC. Now, there are people who defend the FEC. Indeed, one of the current administrators, one of the current FEC members, Lee Goodman, who's one of the Republican commissioners, said, Congress set this place up to gridlock. This agency is functioning as Congress intended. This isn't democracy collapsing all around us. And so basically he's saying that, hey, gridlock is what they wanted, and we're giving you gridlock. And this is, you know, coming from one of the Republican commissioners. But he has a point. If the status quo is what you want in terms of not enforcing the law, then gridlock is good. And so if you think that dark money is not a bad thing in the election process, and that everyone should have the opportunities to spend as much and be able to raise money and give as much money and spending on elections as they want to without accountability, well, then it's good to have a 3-3 split on the FEC because that means campaign finance law will never be enforced the way the commissioner said. And so I think when Lee Goodman says that this is intending it's operated, he revealed a lot. He revealed that this is, in fact, what they wanted was to not enforce the law at the national level, and that's exactly what we're getting. Now, defenders of the FEC also point out, if you look at the overall statistics on the votes taken by the FEC, they point out that, well, they do agree on a lot of stuff. And this was a report from a group called the Center for Competitive Politics, and they're in favor of basically, First Amendment protections for all campaign spending, and so, very little regulation would be their preferred outcome. And this defender of the FEC pointed out that on all votes since 2014, 86% of the votes did have bipartisan majorities on the board. So either 6-0, 5-1 or 4-2 decisions, 83% on substantive motions actually had that support, and only 14% were actually deadlocked 3-3. So you see those statistics and, that's not so bad. If it's only 14% are deadlocked, maybe it isn't so bad. Maybe it's really not that gridlocked. So I went back and looked at the FEC website just this morning to check this out. Look back at all their votes on advisory opinions that they're asked to issue going back to June. And there were about 5 or 6 votes they had in that time. And they were all on fairly trivial things. Like they're basically, they can agree on approving the audit of the Oakland County Democratic Committee that has to put forward their statement. And so these pretty non-controversial things are, here's one from their most recent meeting in October. From the Hillary for America campaign. The commission concluded the attendees' payments for their own food and beverages and valet parking services at campaign events were not considered contributions to the campaign committee under FEC Act of 1971. Okay, great, so valet parking is not covered. Woohoo, yeah, we got that one. And so in the meantime, we can spend billions of dollars in elections unaccounted and dark money. So yeah, they can agree 6-0 on things like that. But then that's what those meaningless statistics then of 86%, they can, so they still do some business. Yes, they haven't shut down entirely. But just to give you another indication of how dysfunctional they are, they don't have a general counsel and haven't had a general counsel for 2.5 years. This is the top attorney that runs their legal department. They can't even agree on who to hire. Okay, so the Republicans want someone to be their chief general counsel who basically takes a First Amendment approach and says that we should be able to do what we want in elections. The Democratic commissioners want someone that will take a stronger regulatory approach. So they can't agree on who to hire. So finally in August, they did agree on an acting general counsel. So they do have someone in the position now for like 12 months, I think, or so. But they, so when they can't even hire the chief attorney to run their operation, it shows how dysfunctional that's become. And that's the model that's being proposed for Wisconsin. That's the kind of dysfunction we'd have here, where you'd have 3-3 deadlocks, 3-3 split on all the important votes, and nothing would get enforced. And so if what you want is gridlock, then this is a great approach. And if you want a status quo where you're not enforcing campaign law, then that would work just fine. Now, this summer, there was some proposed legislation at the national level that would overhaul the FEC to make it more functional and to break the gridlock. So far, that hasn't progressed through the committee stage, but at least there's some people in Congress. It was Derek Kilmer from Washington and Jim Renacci from Ohio, Republican, who introduced the bill to try to get some bipartisan reform of the FEC. And so at the same time, we're trying to emulate the FEC in Wisconsin. The FEC in Washington, people are recognizing, hey, this isn't working. We need to change it and go to something more like we have with the JAB right now. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to mention then is what is an alternative, and what, because clearly something is going to be changed with the structure of the JAB. I think the ideas that Kevin Kennedy outlined were good, having more openness, more transparency on the election side of things, keeping the ethics side more in secrecy for the reasons that he outlined. But the idea, I think, is the one that really should be the most promising to the critics of the JAB, is this idea for having the two ex officio members for the board, where you'd have one Democratic partisan, one Republican partisan, who'd be ex officio members, who would sit in on the discussions to be able to see what's happening. And if their concern truly is that this is a partisan organization that's operating behind the scenes to undermine democracy, well, then you could have your representative sit there on the board, actually see what happens, and then you'd be able to report back to your partisan leaders that this is what's going on. And I think that should take care of the concern, if that indeed is the sincere concern here, would be to have those partisan ex officio members. And I think that should help quite a lot. These wouldn't be voting members, they would just be there to observe. And so it seems to me that's a good alternative to dismantling what has been held up as really the best approach to election administration in this country, as an alternative to either partisan administering elections, which we have in 37 states, or bipartisan approaches, which tend to be gridlocked. And so this model of a nonpartisan approach, as opposed to bipartisan or or partisan, is actually a much better approach. And I hope that we can actually stick with that basic structure that we have.
You're listening to The Future of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board, or GAB, sponsored by the Madison Institute. The talk took place on October 10, 2015, at the Sequoia Public Library in Madison.
Thank you very much, David. Our next speaker will be Mike McCabe, who for 15 years was the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, left the organization to write a book called Blue Jeans in High Places. Mike?
I have had the opportunity, because of my past work, I appeared regularly before the Elections Board. I've appeared before the Government Accountability Board. I've also had business before the Federal Election Commission. I've filed complaints with the FEC, and I've discussed matters with FEC staff and with commissioners. So I've had that unique opportunity to have had personal interaction with all four agencies that are subject of discussion here today. And one of the things that strikes me about the legislators who've put forward this proposal to get rid of our Government Accountability Board is that almost none of them were around when we had the State Elections Board or the State Ethics Board. None of them have had any personal experience with those old agencies. They are operating out of near total ignorance of how the system used to work. And I think it's also fair to say that almost none of them have ever had any interaction with the FEC, because they are state officials. They have never run for office at the federal level. What I can tell you is that the government accountability model, from my practical experience, is vastly superior to what we had. I did file my share of complaints with the State Elections Board and brought matters to the attention of the Ethics Board as well. And I'm sure that Kevin and the staff there found me to be quite the pest. I'm sure they weren't pleased to see me when I would show up to testify before them. And I'm sure the Government Accountability Board probably has found me to be a pest as well. But what I found was that on a repeated basis, the complaints we filed with the Elections Board were summarily dismissed, or when they couldn't find a way to dismiss the complaint because we had people dead to rights, they would give the violator the tiniest of slaps on the wrist. I can't tell you how many complaints ended in $25 fines or $50 fines. With the Government Accountability Board, we didn't even have to file complaints. If we raised an issue that showed apparent violations of the law, they would take action, and we started seeing $1,000 fines or $5,000 fines. We started seeing enforcement action that we simply didn't see from the Elections Board and Ethics Board. And as Kevin said, the genesis of the legislation to create the Government Accountability Board was because of what was known as the caucus scandal. And when I was director of the Democracy Campaign at the time, and we helped reporters expose some of what was being exposed then. We worked very closely with Dee Hall at the Wisconsin State Journal and others. And the Democracy Campaign ended up filing complaints along with Common Cause in Wisconsin with both the State Elections Board and Ethics Board asking for an investigation, asking for the launching of a criminal probe. And neither agency would take that step. Neither agency would deal with the clear evidence that was appearing in the newspaper on a daily basis and investigate. And if it had not been for an enterprising local district attorney who was willing to launch a John Doe investigation, that entire episode in Wisconsin's political history could well have been swept under the rug. That led us to conclude that what we had was a horribly flawed system in place. And what we needed was an independent and nonpartisan agency that could act in a different manner than what we were seeing from the Elections Board and Ethics Board. I once issued a statement that described the old Elections Board as a jury of the politician's pals, and of course made no friends with the Elections Board by saying such a thing. But I stand by those words. That was a jury of the politician's pals, and that was orchestrated gridlock. They didn't take action because they were set up not to take action. And I've seen a very different experience with the Government Accountability Board. Now, after we filed those complaints asking for an investigation, and after the two agencies refused to investigate, but an enterprising district attorney did take action and a John Doe investigation was launched, and it resulted in the criminal convictions of top legislative leaders, and it resulted in a cleaning of the House, and it resulted in a push for legislation that would change the agencies that we had. I was then one of many, many people who was asked for input about what that legislation should look like. I talked to the major legislative leaders at the time, on both sides, both parties. I dealt with Representative Mark Gundrum, who was the Assembly Elections Committee chair at the time, and is no longer in the legislature. He was instrumental in writing the legislation, but he's no longer there. He's now a judge. And so I was involved in discussions about what the legislation should look like, creating the GAB. And I didn't like everything about that legislation. There were a couple of things that really stuck in my craw, but overall I was willing to swallow hard and say, you know what, we'll support it. We'll say that this is the way we ought to go. Overall it was great legislation, and overall it gave us a better system. But like I said, there were two things that really stuck in my craw about that legislation, and Kevin actually addressed one of them. The legislation really put the work of the new Government Accountability Board much more in the shadows than it should be. The law was written to prevent the deliberations of the board, materials presented to the board, evidence before the board. The law was written to prevent any of that from seeing the light of day, to be public information. And I thought that was a huge mistake. The agency should be able to operate out in the full sunlight. And the public should have the ability to know what the board is considering, what evidence is before the board. But legislators at the time, that made them very uncomfortable, and they weren't willing to have that kind of transparency. So that's not the agency's fault. It's not the agency that is behaving in a way that is less than transparent. The law was written to prevent them. They'd be breaking the law if they operated in a more transparent fashion. And that's part of the legislation that I had deep misgivings about. But when I looked at 100% of the proposal, I said, overall, this is going to get Wisconsin to a far better place, and it deserves support. The other thing that I really hated about that bill, and I had to swallow hard to be able to support it, was that it created a home court advantage for public officials. That when a public official is accused of criminal wrongdoing and faces the possibility of landing in court, they're able to effectively choose a home court advantage. They can, if the crime is alleged to have occurred here in Dane County because it happened at the Capitol, they can still have their case heard back in their home county, wherever they're from. And we saw the former Assembly Speaker initially convicted of criminal misconduct, but was able over the course of 7 or 8 years to be granted a new trial, and he ended up back in Waukesha County. And then a plea agreement was reached in Waukesha County that basically let him skate. That was not the fault of the legal system. That was the way that law was written. Now, no other citizen, none of you would have the ability to go court shopping. If you're accused of a crime in a particular county, that's where you're held accountable. That's where you stand trial. None of you would get to go court shopping. Public officials get to go court shopping. So to me, we could strengthen the Government Accountability Board. If the Government Accountability Board is to be reformed, we could strengthen it in two important ways. We could get rid of all the legal language in that initial law that prevents the board and its staff from showing the people of Wisconsin what they're dealing with and what evidence is before them. And that would be a great change to the law. And we could also get rid of the home court advantage. We could strengthen enforcement of our ethics and elections and campaign finance laws in those ways. So, final thought. One of the things that I've heard about this proposal is that it's needed because the Government Accountability Board is a failure. Well, the law school at Ohio State University has studied systems nationally and concluded that Wisconsin's system is a national model that should be copied by states around the country, that other states should have what Wisconsin has. Yet our legislators say that this system is a failure. And all I would say to you is think about what the people at the law school at Ohio State University have to gain from saying that this is a national model that ought to be replicated, and then think what legislators have to gain by telling you that it's a failure, and then judge the credibility of those making those kinds of judgments. And what I'm hearing from legislators is that some of them say that we need to go back to the old elections board and ethics board model because it was superior. My personal experience is that is not true, but that's what they tell us. Kevin said that this is about control, but I think Professor Cannon made the important additional observation. This is not only about control, but this is about engineering gridlock. This is about creating conditions so that there can be a lawless environment, so that they can do as they please and there will be nobody to stop them. And that's why it's so telling that some of the legislators at the Capitol are saying that what we really need is a model like the FEC. Now, I have personally found the FEC to be a black hole. Evidence of clear violations of federal law that we have brought to their attention led to absolutely nothing. No action whatsoever. To me, that's by design. That's not a coincidence. That's by design. But that has been my personal practical experience. And as Professor Cannon said, I don't think he said, I don't think he told you who said it, he might have, but it was the FEC's own chair that described the commission as worse than dysfunctional. And went on to say that, told the New York Times that commissioners are barely on speaking terms, cross-aisle negotiations are infrequent, and as a result, there's no consensus on which rules to enforce. Turns out, they can't even agree on what food to order at their meetings. That's actually true. They have had a hard time agreeing on the menu for food at their meetings. And that is not an accident. That is exactly what Congress wants. That is true. And I think that it's so important for us to realize that this legislation is not an accident here in Wisconsin either. What they want are commissions that are incapable of enforcing the law. They certainly want to rewrite the laws and make legal things that are today not legal. But to the extent that we have ethics rules and campaign finance laws and lobbying laws, they want commissions that are incapable of taking action and enforcing those laws. That's something that we all need to be fully aware of, because that speaks volumes about the nature of the fight that we're up against here.
Thank you very much, Mike. Our next guest I'm pleased to introduce is former State Senator Dale Schultz. He was first elected to the legislature, I believe, in 1982. And so he served in the legislature as a Republican for over 30 years. He represented all of Wisconsin, west of Dane County and south of the Wisconsin River, and more than that. Sauk and Juneau, part of Richland County, is going up north from there, way past Toma. Dale has distinguished himself, exercising an independence of judgment and a courage to stand apart from the majority of his caucus.
I would like to just put things into perspective. I did spend 32 years in the legislature, which is long enough to know better, believe me. And I am very fond these days of saying to people, it's not my zoo and those aren't my monkeys anymore. It's a big burden sometimes when you have to recognize that you've got your say, so now you have to defend the whole all the time. And now I'm free to say what I think, and it takes a lot of stress off me. And as I look at my friend Kevin Kennedy, I see stress that I used to see in the mirror. Sometimes maybe I didn't see it, but others saw it. And I just want to say, Kevin, in a larger context, this whole issue is about control, and it should be viewed from the perspective of efforts to get rid of Wisconsin's historical civil service system, and to extend control into the bureaucracy. You are a fine example of the best civil service has to offer. I always found him fair, thoughtful, discreet, and there was never any lack of clarity in what was the proper way to do things. And if you did them that way, you didn't get into trouble. I remember one time when my friend Matt Palmer was interviewing me, and I don't know what the subject was, but at one point he just stopped and he said, you know, Dale, if you're not doing anything wrong, you've got nothing to worry about. And, you know, it just seemed to me uncommonly a good common sense to be offering somebody. And I think these days, I have a very different role. I teach down at the University of Platteville a course called Citizenship and Practical Political Decision Making. So I spend 3 hours one night a week with millennials. And in the morning, I get up and I stroll down to Main Street and Richland Center and meet with the other Romeos in the back of Bailey's Paint Store, retired old men eating out. And what I have learned from these recent experiences is that there is a lot that millennials have in common with aging baby boomers, and it's that there's a real disgust, distrust, and even worse, of government these days. Of course, you may have noticed that in sort of how the polls are calling the elections. Everybody hates the insiders. And it's shocking, the insiders and the political elites, but it's not shocking to me when I actually go out and talk to people who are just folks who don't have a vested interest. And I think that's what's, you know, in my opinion, what is significant. My friend Tim Cullen and I spend quite a bit of time going around the state talking about redistricting these days, and Tim is fond of pointing out to the groups that gather to talk to us that he says what we're doing is a lot more popular outside the Capitol than it is inside the Capitol. And you know, you may wonder, why would we do that? Well, I think both of us are concerned about something that we love, a government, an institution that we love, the state legislature, both houses, is at risk of becoming worse than a laughing stock and being utterly distrusted and flat out hated by the general public. I think that we spend way too much time worrying about being a good Democrat or good Republican, a good liberal or a good conservative, than we do about being good Americans. And I think it is very, very important that when we talk about issues like this, and we will have differences of opinion. My friend Mark Miller and I, over the years, had a lot of disagreements. But I don't think either one of us ever hated each other. It was a contest of ideas, and that's what I think democracy offers us. And when it turns into a blood sport, everyone loses. So for me, the question is, what do we do to renew that sense of citizenship, renew the institutions that are crucial in allowing us to have that contest of ideas in a thoughtful way for the benefit of all? And as has been noted here, we have had a rough go of it in recent years in Wisconsin with scandals. It's not something that I'm particularly proud of. I think I went through 5 or 6 of them in the legislature. And they're not good chapters in Wisconsin's history. But we have managed to do reforms throughout the history of Wisconsin. Civil service was something that came to us after timber and railroad barons bought the legislature. And it's worked very well. And to the extent that we have problems or they are identified, we should reform it. But we shouldn't let people croon about common sense reforms in efforts to dismantle what has protected us for 100 years. And nor should we ignore the fact that we've in recent years had scandals, and we had a response to that, putting together the Government Accountability Board, and that it has served us relatively well. Again, to the extent there are problems, I think it's fair to discuss them and to change some things. First time I heard the idea of having advocates on the inside, that may hold some promise. But I think it's been pointed out here that we've had a legislative or a couple of legislative audits that have said, by and large, this is working very well and there's no evidence of bias. Now, I have happened to have some, you know, firsthand experience as a legislative leader dealing with the Government Accountability Board, and I'm here to tell you I never had any problems. Did I have to call Kevin or his staff? Yes. Did they do their job? Was that sometimes problematic for me? Yes. On the other hand, as somebody who now has the luxury of not having a view as an American, as a citizen of Wisconsin, unfettered by partisanship, I will tell you that it was always entirely fair, nonpartisan, and straightforward. And I think that's something that all of us can jointly agree, regardless of our political beliefs, is important for our collective future and for future generations. So I'm here to say that I think that we ought to look at what's going on in this state and the efforts to politically control what happens in our government, and that we ought to all collectively stand up and say that we don't want these so-called common sense reforms because we know the system has served us relatively well, that we don't want to change how we administer ethics and elections and say it as loudly and clearly and full-throated as we can as our legislature meets, and at the same time be clear to the extent that people can spot specific problems and they're willing to debate them in front of the public. We're willing to go along with that, and we're not against any change. But until somebody comes up with a compelling reason why we need to change, why what they have is better, then I think we should stay with the laws that we have. And these institutions have served both civil service and the GAB, have served our state well for many years and made us national examples. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dale. Judge Gerald Nickel, to come up and speak for a few moments. Judge Nickel was DA of Madison, I think back in the 70s, as a Republican. Became a Dane County judge for 17 years, and currently is chair of the Government Accountability Board, and is, as Kevin said earlier, Kevin Kennedy's boss.
I would just do a postscript here. In my letter to the leadership, which was by me only, it's not on behalf of the board, because the board has not met and made a decision how they're going to react to the legislation that's now been introduced. But I asked them to pause for a year, and I asked them to appoint two, one from each party, representatives to come into our forum and to observe us for a year. Because the criticism, which much is, I would say, most unfounded that has been leveled at us, just isn't true. And I think if they had an opportunity to observe how these six judges manage the agency, we don't micromanage, but we are completely informed in all major decisions other than day-to-day, which we have delegated. Do we always agree? No, we don't. But we're collegial, and we get along, and we get the work of government done and the work of this agency. And I think if they paused and had this opportunity, we would not see the type of charade that we're seeing right now. And I'm hoping, at least in the Senate, that we'll get some attention. Obviously, in the press conference with the introduction of the bill the other day, it was basically an assault on us. We have made both sides unhappy as we've charted our nearly 8 years now, but that's our job. And you know, as a judge, you're used to that, because every time you make a decision, one of the parties wins, one of the parties loses. So somebody's always unhappy. And that doesn't bother us. We just come at it very honestly. And so I'm hoping we're going to get some support for the idea. I'm hoping that we can have some dialogue. I'm hoping that this agency can continue to exist for another year. And my reason for writing the letter is, I don't know what would happen at the end of a year, is that this is a critical year. It's critical because of all the elections that are coming up, and the fact that we have the responsibility for training these 1,853 municipal clerks and 72 county clerks so that they're up to date with voter ID, so they're up to date with the finance law if it gets passed, so that they're up to date, although that would be more important for political committees, but so they're up to date on the other aspects of the election where the laws are changed, where we have the responsibility to do the training. And we also have the fact that we will have to examine all the nomination papers. That's our responsibility for these elections, both in the spring, which I believe are 49 judicial elections that are up in the spring. And I can't remember the total number in the fall, but it's for all the state representatives, state senators, district attorneys, and and congressional people. And so we have a lot on our plate this coming year, and if we're going to have a big hiccup in June, it's going to and could cause some real problems with the administration of the agency and the efficiency of the staff and the conduct during the elections. So the only other reason I wrote the letter is we have a staff and we've lost, I think, 6 or 7 crucial members, people who are IT and have skills that are very, very helpful to what we do, and we do a lot. We only have a staff of about 38 people. And to lose those, at least if we had some assurance that this was going to go on for another year, that they would take a fair look, maybe we wouldn't have the exodus, which will cause us problems and also cause the public problems, because it's hard to get these people up and ready so they can do the job, because you just don't come with those skills when you hire off the street. So thank you very much.
Diane Herman Brown from the Sun Prairie Municipal Clerk. She said, those of us who have been around for a while remember the days of the State Election Board. The GAB structure was a pleasant and efficient change that provides us better communication, training, resources, and consistency in election administration. When we worked under the direction of the State Elections Board, we never had a clear, concise, or timely directives, and our concerns and our problems were never a consideration. The only training we had was what we read about in said state statutes or shared with other clerks, because the State Elections Board didn't have the funds for training. When the change to the GAB occurred, all of these issues went away and municipalities saved considerable staff time and revenue. But most important was the consistency in election administration.
You've just listened to a panel discussion titled The Future of Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board, or GAB, sponsored by the Madison Institute. The speakers included Kevin Kennedy, director of the GAB, David Cannon, UW-Madison Professor of Political Science, Mike McCabe, former director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and current director of Blue Jean Nation, Dale Schultz, former Republican state senator from Richland Center, and Gerald Nickel, the current chair of the GAB. This talk took place on October 10, 2015, at the Sequoia Public Library in Madison. For this and other thought-provoking programs, go to the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of the sponsor.